Welcome to a podcast of the Mike Novak Show. You can listen to Mike live Sunday mornings from 9 to 11 Central on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Welcome to Back on the Beat. Here's your host, Dick Kay.
Nope. Here I come to save the day.
Welcome to Mighty House. This is a radio show for people with
no, 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 no,
Here he is, Mike Novak.
Happy. Boing.
Live from the beautiful Showcase Studios on North Milwaukee Avenue in Chicago, in between Andy's Deli and Lido Banquets, and just a punch key's throw away from the Polish capital of the Western Hemisphere, it's The Mike Novak Show, Chicago's only locally broadcast deep green gardening and environment program, heard every Sunday right here on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. True currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees. Our business is people and their love for trees. If Mike says he's growing a pair, he's literally growing a pair. What did you think he meant? Get your minds out of the irrigation ditch. Here he is, Mike Novak.
Right.
Wow, we have achieved new intro here on the Mike Novak Show.
Yes, we have.
How about that? So I guess we're officially in the new digs here.
Yes.
On Milwaukee Avenue.
And they are quite lovely.
They are.
They really are.
The people come in here and they're quite impressed with the facilities. And when
it's
all
a lot better than those two tin cans and the wire we had at the last place.
We had three tin cans
We had two tin cans and one aluminum.
That's why it didn't work so well, huh?
Mm-hmm.
It's the aluminum. Aluminum doesn't pick up quite as well.
No, it didn't.
You know, I've got your papers here.
Oh, I need those, don't I?
Yes, you do.
I'll come get those.
Okay, great. Wow, we've got a really good show today. Lots going on. I always say that, but in particular, I'm very happy to have my guests in the studio today, who are friends of mine and colleagues of mine, and they represent an organization that I helped start about 10 years ago, and that's the Midwest Ecological Landscaping Association. So Carol Becker and Amy Beltamaki are in studio. We'll get to them in just a second. And what we're going to talk about is the landscaping business, and people call it the green industry. And it might not be as green as you think. And that's kind of the reason Mila exists. In the first half hour, talk about where we're going with that. Of course, Rick DeMaio weather at 9:30. In the second hour, something that's actually kind of related to Mila sustainability. The NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, did a report. Here you go. Here's your papers. signs his papers. The NRDC did a report on rainwater, and they, you know, it seems like a no-brainer. I'm wondering why they had to do a real report on this, but it makes sense. And came to the conclusion that we can do a lot better than we are right now in saving the rainwater, the water that hits our roofs. Certainly in Chicago, certainly in a lot of places in the country. And Noah Garrison was the chief writer on that report with the NRDC, and we're going to talk about that at 10 o'clock. And then, see, I did this last. I put this last. This is, you know who's really good at this is Norman Goldman during the week. He's on 5 days a week from 5 to 8 here right on Chicago's Progressive Talk. He's really good at teasing things. Me, not so good. Garden Design Magazine said, I'm highly distractible, and that's me. I'm very distractible. But today I've got it all together, and I've got it in order, and I'm teasing you about the final half hour of the show because I'm going to have a guy on who's going to be part of the Wildflower Preservation and Propagation Committee 20th Annual Natural Landscaping Seminar. See, it's all seems to be revolving around landscaping today. But the WPPC is a great organization up in McHenry County. And Chris Anker is a Cook County Forest Preserve District field biologist, and he studies coyotes. And I'm going to tell you something. If you live in the city, if you live in the suburbs, you got coyotes around, even if you don't know it. In fact, I think what we're going to do, Heather, for that, let's stage, let's get a small dog and have a coyote haul away a small dog in kind of honor of that talk.
They wander around my suburb. I've seen them.
Have you seen coyotes?
I have seen coyotes walk straight down the middle of the street like they were going to buy milk.
And that's the point that Chris Anker will tell us about. He'll talk about where they are, whether they're a danger, why they're here. You know, I
called the authorities. I called like the non-emergency number, and I said, because at first it's like you think it's a dog, and then when you get a better look at it, you're like, that's not a dog. And yeah. I was like, oh yeah, they're like, yeah, give it 20 minutes, you'll probably see the other one. I'm like, the other one?
Well, they go in pairs, and they're the alpha pairs, and they're the ones who mate and have offspring, and then there's the extended family, then there's the loners, and there's all kinds of different...
I have plenty of questions for this guy, because I've had a sighting in my neighborhood more than once.
So I had to, so I'm proud of myself, I put it at the end of the show so everybody will stick around, because everybody wants to know about coyotes. It's just so cool, unless your little dog has been carried off by one. But
I wanted it to call back rabbits because we had the West Nile took out half the crow population and we were inundated with rabbits. So when I saw the coyotes, I was like, "Well, catch some rabbits."
And that's the other question we'll have: how do you really pronounce it? If you study it, is it coyote or coyote?
I say coyote.
Yeah, as in Y-L-E.
Coyote.
And that was my headline.
Super genius.
And
I'll find it on YouTube.
Okay, yeah. But the problem, we can't play a Wile E. Coyote and Roadrunner cartoon on the air here because there's no dialogue.
No, well, we have to find one where Wile E. actually fights Bugs Bunny or a different character because that's when he actually spoke.
Yeah, but I don't want Wile E. Coyote to speak.
I'll find a really good one with no audio of them speaking, and we'll put it on the Facebook.
That was a
show
mistake
page
on their part to have him speak.
But so that's when he called himself a super genius, and it was really funny.
Well, okay,
he made carrots full of nitro.
If you find that, go ahead. We'll play
okay,
that.
I will.
All right. And already got a tweet here. 2 weeks ago, there was a coyote at the baseball field at UIC at Halstead and Taylor. See, there you go. So I went to the Natural Landscape Seminar last year. It was amazing, extremely informative. But was it the Mila Landscaping Seminar? We also got already a good morning to the two of us. Love the new intro. So, and another tweet that says, "Broadcast." This is how I should have done it. I'm going to have to steal this. Cope Dog said, "Broadcasting from USDA Zone 6A, it's the Mike Novak Show." I like that because we are now in 6A. So they tell us, the USDA hardiness zone maps. Let me turn on a couple of mic. Were you not aware of that, Carol?
No, I mean, I knew it was coming, and it was obvious in the work that we do, but I didn't know that it was official.
I believe it is. USDA says so. It must be true, right?
Yeah, and the Arbor Foundation came out with it a couple months ago, I think, too.
Well, the USDA map just came out a couple of weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I have a link to it on my homepage. Go to MikeNovak.net. Amy Beltamaki and Carol Becker from the Midwest Ecological Landscaping Association. Hi.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning. And Amy, you might recognize the name. She's been on the show before talking about Root Riot.
Go Root Riot.
Woohoo!
Yay.
One of my, I think it's my favorite name for a community garden, Root Riot.
Yeah, can I talk about it? We have two new community gardens.
Yeah, go ahead. Let's do a plug right now.
This summer. Yeah, so...
wait, there we go.
Thank you.
Buena
Park.
There we go.
Buena Park Community Group is... we're working with them to use one of the abandoned lots in their community. And we have another one going in on the west side if everything works out. So lots of planning before the growing season begins.
See, you're not like mine, which is... in my neighborhood, we're not interested in being an empire the way that Root Riot is.
We're not either. It's just that people call us and we can't say no. We're like, of course, we'll be delighted to help you use that abandoned lot. It's true.
Yeah, but you got to have a real organization to do that.
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. In our minds.
But do you have bylaws and dues and stuff?
Oh, we encourage the gardens to do bylaws and we give them drafts. I mean, we do a lot of help you out, get started.
Uh-huh.
In the end, it's about the community coming together and forming and shaping that space.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I'm impressed that you're expanding again this year.
Yeah. That's what happens every year. It gets warmer and someone wants to put a community garden in. So there we are out there helping.
Great. And Seamus Ford, of course, is part of that.
Fabulous. Seamus is actively engaged in them. Yes.
You guys are great. Well, congratulations. And I'm glad that you are continuing to expand.
Yep. But
you're here today to talk about Mila, the two of you, and you know, this is in full disclosure, in the interest of full disclosure, I, as I said before, helped found the organization.
No, in the interest of full disclosure, Mike, you did found the organization.
Well, with Connie Cunningham, and
yeah,
I put this.
You did. You
I don't
did.
Know if you didn't see the story that I put up on my website, MikeNovak.net, about how this came together. It's up there. And as I wrote on this week's show, it was 10 years ago that organic landscape designer Connie Cunningham pretty much grabbed me by the lapels and said, "We need to start an ecological landscaping organization."
And here we are.
Yeah, right. And there's more. And 10 years later, here we are. And it's still alive. And any not-for-profit that survives 10 years is doing pretty well. Anybody who's ever run a not-for-profit knows that. It's really hard. So congratulations to us, I guess, although I'm not really involved.
And thanks to the companies, including, by the way, Care of Trees, that's sponsoring this hour of your show.
Right. They're a big sponsor of
Mila.
They were
our original sponsor, and they've been our sponsor for all 10 years. They've been joined by Lurvies, Bartlett Tree Experts, Unilock, and Piso Companies to give us major sponsorship every year.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks to them, and thanks to our conference sponsors who keep on making Mila possible. And not only that, but help us grow.
Mm-hmm. And it's great to have sponsors. I can tell
you
that. I love my sponsors, including the Care of Trees. You know, I call it, you know, it's lefty capitalism. That's not a bad thing.
Right.
That's a good thing.
And you talk about deep green, your program being deep green is a great description for your show, Mike.
Thank you.
Midwest Organics Recycling, you know Ted Kruger. He's been doing what he does, proving that it can be a sustainable business model
for
so many years. And he steps up, and he's like the major sponsor of our conference. So we do a no-waste event.
And that's the other thing. I can remember several years ago when we started trying to do these conferences in a more sustainable way. The very first time, and you remember this, Carol, we were at the Chicago Botanic Garden.
Yep.
And sorry to bust you guys over there, but, you know, there's a learning curve for everybody.
Yep.
We're at the Chicago Botanic Garden, and we have sustainable utensils and paper, and even the food stuff. We're going to compost, and so we separate it all into these different bins, and we had who was it that was in charge of that? That was.
Oh, golly, I don't remember.
I'm blanking on her name, a compost queen.
Lynn Bement.
Lynn Bement,
yes.
She's the compost queen.
Yes,
and Lynn is taking care of all this and making sure everything gets into the right bin, okay? And she goes in to hear one of the speakers. Mm. Comes back out, everything has been dumped and taken away and dumped into the big pile.
Oh.
And she was heartbroken, and we were all... Went, okay, see, this is what you're up against when you try to do something like this.
Lynn is actually stepping up for this conference and taking care of the composting, too. It's still an issue. I mean, trying to figure out how to really, truly do a zero-waste event. It's tough. It's tough these days.
I'm looking forward to the day when the conference centers say to us, oh, we routinely do zero-waste events. If you weren't doing a zero-waste event, we'd charge a penalty.
Yep. That'd be a fabulous
exactly.
turnaround.
That's why are
way
people not
really
doing it that
be.
Way?
But we have to thank the University Center in Lake County, which is where we're going to be this year. They really partnered with us to make this happen and came up with some great adjustments to our catering plan that will help a lot. I mean, we're still providing the bio bags, and we're still, you know, helping to say, this is how it's done, and isn't that hard? But they stepped up and are really helping.
And that takes, you know, and you look at that, and that's just a side note of what it is
that's right.
Mila's doing. And for folks who are tuning in, and I'm talking about the Midwest Ecological Landscaping Association, and they go, yeah, so isn't that the green industry? Isn't the green industry green? Well, 10 years ago, Connie and I looked at it and said, no. It's not. It's not really green, and there's too much of the same old, and what we're talking about is the same old chemicals and the same old plant palette, and you know, and Dan Costa, who works at Vern Goer's greenhouse in Hinsdale, will have to put on his muffler now, not to listen, because he thinks I beat up on the industry way too much. I don't beat up on the industry too much. I just try to make it accountable. And that's kind of what we were trying to do with Mila, is get landscapers and designers and growers and educators, anybody we could think of who wanted to go in a sustainable direction. And, you know, 10 years later, that is more and more the mainstream, is it not?
Yeah, absolutely, Mike. And what you said is the truth, is that we have some fabulous leaders now in the green industry who really come together at Mila. And it's not just something they should do. It's something they want to do. It's a passion. It's a core part of their business. And we're really privileged this year at the Mila conference on February 23rd to have representatives from these leadership areas to come and talk to everybody and share their knowledge. I think 10 years ago when you started, there was really a shortage of not only how to do, but why to do it and what's good to do. And now more and more there's people who are standing up saying, you can do this and deliver results, and it really makes a difference. And you had Jack Pizzo on your show last year, and he's always been a really fabulous
sponsor. A couple of
weeks ago. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, last week, yeah. He's really been a really strong sponsor of Mila. And, you know, he has built a company absolutely around the idea of natives, and more people are buying those and asking for those and requesting those. And the more we can get people to ask for sustainable products and sustainable installers and people who care about the environment, the better off we're going to be. And Mila is all about empowering people to ask those questions and having people who can answer those questions for them.
And as Mila moves forward, you know, there was always, and nobody likes to hear the inside machinations and arguments, but there's always been a question in the organization: are we going after the industry? Are we going after the homeowner? And, you know, in the best of all possible worlds, everybody gets involved,
yep.
and the homeowner
yep.
puts the pressure on the designers and right. on the architects and says, "I need to have something sustainable." But a lot of people aren't aware of that and how to do that. And that's what these conferences are about, like the one you're going to have this week.
And the perception out there still remains that it costs more to do, quote, the right thing, the sustainable thing. And yet I just read yesterday a study of one specific landscape. The maintenance cost after sustainable installation was $3,000 a year for traditional and $800 a year for sustainable. And that's where the real benefits are derived for the homeowner, is the long-term cost.
And that happens only if people all get on board and everybody wants
right.
that, because what drives the numbers down is demand. You can't – you were talking about Midwest Organics and people needing compost. They do compost products, and this is one of the great compost sources in our area. And folks say, well, where can I get really decent compost? Or that's the place to go, is
right.
one of the great places.
Well, in fact, when we started Mila, we used to talk about how do we help homeowners find any kind of sustainable product.
Yeah, we used to have board meetings, and I guess what we learned is don't ever bring a bottle of wine to a board meeting. But
those were the best meetings ever.
The best meetings ever. But we would end up going round and round about compost. You know, here, I don't know why it always dissolved into a conversation about compost. It just seemed to be because it actually tells you something, because everybody needs compost to work in their gardens, and yet not everybody knows where to get the best stuff. People are still fumbling, and that's because there aren't regional and there aren't national standards.
It's not even that though, Mike. That's a critical question. It's a critical conversation that Mila should be having. It's not the beginning. It's not just the install. It's the end. It is the cradle to cradle life cycle approach. What happens when you're done using that stuff? How do you reuse it so it comes into the nutrient cycle and plants can grow out of it? That's powerful. That's what Mila always talks about.
All right.
And
you
know, Amy's our conference chair this year, and I have to say she has put together an amazing series of both speakers and workshops to promote that conversation.
And that's our tease. I'm going to pay some bills here, but when we come back, Amy Beltamaki and Carol Becker from Mila will talk about the conference this week, why it's important, the 10th Annual Conference 2012, which is titled Balance, Natural Systems, and the Built Environment. It's this Thursday, February 23rd, at the University Center of Lake County at the College of Lake County, and that's 1200 University Center Drive, Grays Lake. Now, all that information's on my website. Go to MikeNovak.net, this week's show, and you can find that. We'll be back with them in just a second. Now, most people don't like surprises. Oh, they might say they do, but you and I know that those people only like surprises on their terms. So if you're a gardener, you want certainty, in an uncertain world, which is a great reason to subscribe to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. That's because the only surprises there are good ones, like special articles that will make you say, cool, I didn't know that. But there are regular features like the question and answer column that you can count on to address problems that have been nagging you for years. And there are reports from all over the Chicagoland area. Hey, where do you think they got the name for the magazine, huh? Those reports let you know about things that are happening in your neck of the region, whether they're events or peculiar weather conditions. Of course, there's the best calendar of gardening and related events in any publication in this area. And then there's my column on the inside back page. Okay, that's what I call a nasty surprise. Get a subscription to Chicagoland Gardening Magazine right now when it can do the most good for 2012. Go to ChicagolandGardening.com or call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
Want to make a positive move in the housing market? Replace your siding and windows. You'll improve your home's look and energy efficiency, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling and energy needs. Siding, windows, solar and wind power, and more. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
Here's a tip from The Care of Trees, actually some comments from The Care of Trees customers, like Bridget from Chicago, who said that her arborist was extremely knowledgeable and helpful when he pruned our very unruly Siberian elm tree. He did a great job and made sure that all of the dead branches were removed. We also appreciated the fact that he showed great care in protecting the surrounding plants in our small but dense city garden. The work was professionally executed, and the work area was cleared of debris. Highly recommended. Then Lori in Cary, Illinois, simply said, excellent service, willingness to go that extra mile. And James in Kenilworth exclaimed, "Wonderful crew, first rate," and he used exclamation marks after that. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard, you're changing your landscaping, or you're moving, invite the certified arborist at the Care of Trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. 847-394-4220. The Care of Trees. Their business is people and their love for trees.
Is pain keeping you from enjoying gardening? Dr. Bonnie Flaster at River North Wellness Center has gentle and effective techniques to get you out of pain and back to doing what you love. Here are two quick tips. First, remember to stretch. Second, use a timer to make sure you take breaks. Come see her at River North Wellness Center and find more tips at rivernorthwellness.com or call 312-642-7545 to make an appointment with Dr. Flaster and get back to feeling good.
The Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. In the studio, I have Carol Becker, who's the executive director of the Midwest Ecological Landscaping Association, and Amy Beltamaki, who is a board member and who helped put this conference this week together. What were you? What did you have? What?
Indeed, I did.
Oh, you were like whispering. I thought you were saying, "No, I didn't."
No, I did.
You did. I did. And what was your goal in organizing this?
I think that Mila is right on the tipping point of just becoming a common household name. And it's not because of the name is so special, but it's because of the passion of the people that are part of this organization. And we have some powerful people here who are sharing their expertise and knowledge. And I wanted to stay true to Mila's kind of base and talk about ecology and land health. And we typically think of things like stewardship or restoration. And in that area, we have Jacob Blue from Applied Ecological Services coming to talk to us. He's been a principal at Applied Ecological Services and there for almost 10 years. He really talks about kind of understanding natural functions in the built environment and how we can work with them. Bartlett Tree, Eric Grossnickel, and Dr. Booth, both of them, I had the privilege of going down to their place in North Carolina last year, and they did an amazing thing that talked about integrated pest management. You think that we need to put chemicals on plants to make them healthy, and they really have a program at Bartlett Tree, and I'm sure the other tree folks do, that talk about how you can use natural insects and natural predators to take care of and restore balance within your community so your trees and your plants do well.
Along that line, I'm sure that's people are concerned about it. Some people are. It's interesting that some people will hire a tree care company or a lawn care company, especially, and never even ask.
Yep.
What are you using?
That's true, but natural lawn care is becoming more and more the tipping point of conversation when you look for a lawn care people. I mean, this vernacular is walking into the normal conversation of people saying, "I don't want chemicals. I don't want it in my water. I don't want it to move to my water table. I don't want my dogs to play it. I don't want my kids to play it." And there really are alternatives. And so it's coming back. I mean, it should have never gone out of fashion, but now it's coming back in fashion. So, you know, when you look at for people to do services in your community, buildings, whatever it is, you know, think about the chemicals that they're using. A lot of people, especially Mila members, have alternative solutions to that.
And, you know, we're seeing that in that natural lawn care area, we have the people who provide that service are in our membership. Competitive Lawn Care down in the southwest suburbs is a sponsor for this conference.
And he's doing
propane, uses
right.
All propane equipment.
He's been on the show.
He's really been an interesting guy. Eric Eric Hansen is just a passionate advocate. So we're really proud to have those kinds of folks. The other thing is we are in Lake County this year because we're starting to partner with the Liberty Prairie Conservancy in Lake County. They have a program called Conservation at Home. this program is also, it is now available not only in Lake County, but in a number, DeKalb County, Kane County. And we are starting with these, with this Conservation at Home program, we're starting to reach homeowners and collaborate with organizations that reach homeowners who are truly interested in this subject. Now, I'm going to make an offer on your show only. This is a Mike Nowak special.
Okay. There we go.
Anyone, any homeowner out there who is interested in these issues and who is not a MELA member, because we have not been promoting our organization to homeowners until now, if you would like to come to our conference, you give me a phone call, and I'll see that you get a special rate. If you listen to the Mike Nowak Show and you know about this because of this show, you can call 312-857-MELA and ask for me, Carol Becker, and I will see that you get a special rate to attend our conference this Thursday.
That number in Chicago, 312-857-MELA. Operators are standing by. Actually, they're sitting. Yeah. Actually, you'll get probably a recorded message right now. But sure. And that's kind of what we hope, is that people get more involved in the matter of landscaping. You know, I'm afraid that when I even say the word landscaping, people's eyes glaze over and they say, well, I'm not a landscaper and I don't really know what I'm doing. And, you know, it's just my yard and I, you know, give me a couple of ewes and a lawn and I'm happy.
But it's your yard. It's also the spaces and places that you live in and grow in. And we've really expanded the idea for this MELA conference out of just the idea of landscaping. We have a couple of people coming and talking about, believe it or not, growing food. The sustainable.
Well, that's the part I wanted to bring up. What I really like what MELA's doing, and I think it's a logical extension of the group, is looking at local food and productive landscapes.
Yes.
and integrating food into the landscape, which is where we're headed.
Yeah, absolutely. So Jeannie Nolan from the Sustainable Edible Gardener, she has been doing this for years, and she really takes it as a calling and a business to have people have vegetables grown locally. And then if you've heard of the word permaculture, I mean, that's the idea of permanent agriculture within the spaces that you live. And Brian Cretton is coming from Michigan, I believe, to talk to us, and he has a garden and a yard that does permaculture there as well. But those are the things that kind of walk into the next segment of the MELA one, which is growing businesses. We can't just put shrubs and yews down in our yards anymore and call that a business. People want more. They want more sustainable products. They want less chemicals. They also want to make simple ways and easy ways for their places to have food that's productive, not just look good. They also want to grow a business. And so we have Jackie Lowing from Sheridan Park Consulting coming and talking in about business growth. John Harris from A5. And thank you, John Harris, for all the work you did on our fabulous brochure and presentation material for the show. He's a principal at 8-5, and he's going to come and talk about sustainability and marketing and how businesses can grow in this green space. We also have Steve Pierce coming, talking about software, believe it or not, which you might not think is really, really associated with landscaping. But the more efficient we can run our businesses and the better we can track what we're doing, the better we'll be able to deliver services and grow
software
up.
Runs the world now.
Software runs the world.
It's all software.
Yeah. And Steve Pierce is going to come in and talk about a product that they use inside Siebert Landscaping that really has changed the way they look at the way they do business and how effective and efficient they are at analyzing the business they do. Those are critical things to grow sustainability.
You were talking about Jeannie Nolan, and I'm doing a presentation with her at the Good Food Festival.
Yay.
And conference.
Fantastic.
Which is March 15th through 17th.
Yeah.
At UIC.
Yeah.
And you know, Jeff Swano is going to talk about using native plants in an urban landscape. I mean, people are interested in that, but they may shy away from it because they don't really know how to do it. They have this idea that native plants are somehow different or more like weeds. Bad comparison. There's so much you can do with native plants.
Can I pick up
plants
on that one? That's a great lead-in.
Yeah.
You know, part of the things that we do in our built environment is the perception how we think it should look rather than how it looks naturally or functions naturally. And we have actually specifically brought in a speaker from the United States Forest Service. She's a social scientist, Lynn Westfall, and her co-sponsor.
Is that your phone ringing there,
it
Carol?
It is. Someone signing up for the MELA conference.
Oh, she's called. They're calling. Yeah. Call this number right now, 312-857-MELA. Ask for Carol Becker.
We're clearly standing by waiting for your phone call. But, Yeah, social perception. So Paul Gopster is going to come and talk to us about social perception. What we think is green is frequently not green, and what we think are weeds are frequently not weeds. So we have an education thing to work with, and we have a perception thing to start talking about. And the more the people who do the installs and think about these spaces understand how to change people's perceptions, the farther along we can move in the more natural and kind of holistic landscaping area that really works in the built environment and augments and nurtures the natural systems.
And she did that ad lib. That's... She's not reading all.
I
she's
care.
Not,
that's right.
I've
that's
got
right.
a teleprompter
so
here,
care.
And she does not.
I care about this stuff. I want you guys to come
you
out
obviously
and learn
do
about
care.
It.
Well, you know, and I think it gets back to what is green. We've had discussions about this before. For one, it's getting to the point you can't even use the word. The word sustainability is so tired. And yet, this is what we have to talk about. What does it mean? Just because you have some plants and you put them in the ground doesn't mean you're green.
No, but talk about resiliency. Talk about the activities that you do contribute to resiliency, whether it's in your house or your family, your school, your community, your yard. The yard plants that you use matter. The community structures that you build, that's why I'm engaged in Root Riot. The buildings that you build, the amount of energy and water, it's all part of a complete system. And we have to talk about a systems approach to building our communities. And that is the link between the natural systems and how we augment and repair and restore those natural systems that we've paved over and how we integrate that in the built environment. And, you know, Jack brought this up last week, but Doug Ptolemy is a fellow who wrote a book, Bringing Nature Home. I would encourage all of you to read that book if you're in the built environment. If you're in a city, every little patch matters. And those native plants that you put in there, that's about resting and nesting spots. It doesn't mean that it's a big forest preserve, but your little patch matters. Your patch matters, your neighbor's patch matters, the neighbor's neighbor's patch matters. And together we can really reintroduce green and sustainability and really create resilient communities.
Jack said that when he yep. was on the program. He said one plant, two plants, whatever, whatever you can do. But as you know, it's and it's not just natives too. What we're finding out, it's also about, you know, as you're doing in Root Riot, growing food. But how do you do that sustainably? Because that's a, you know,
it's true. Go Mila, go Mila.
My phone goes off all the time here, Carol, so don't worry about it. Actually, yours is a much more pleasant ring than mine. Well, I want to thank you both for dropping by on a Sunday morning. Great stuff. If you want more information about Mila's 10th annual conference, I can't believe it's been 10 years. Unbelievable.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Mike.
Deep green. Go, Mike.
Wait a second. I believe, do we have a... Is it... I don't have it here. Okay. I'll have to... Yes?
Can I have one more second?
Go
we
for
have,
it.
We have Richard Hayden coming to talk from Hydrotech about green roofs, and he's really going to address critically the idea of that Mike talks to about what is sustainability, what's green, what's the critical conversation, and how we move forward with it. What's the fake from the past, and how do we move forward into the truth of the future? So thank him for doing that, and thank Hydrotech for allowing him to do that. We also have a really precious and special speaker, Doug Reed from Reed Hildebrandt. He's not really from our Midwest area. He's from the East Coast. But, folks, when we talk about aesthetics and how things look, the beauty of the built environment is something that our humanity and our civilizations crave. We've defined beauty in a particular way, and we can also build that in a resilient, sustainable, and creative and beautiful way. And Doug Reed, I'm very, very thankful, will come out and talk to us about it. So please come to the Mila conference and send the folks in your organization. The more that we can get people to hear the message, the more they will share the message, the more that message will be spread. So please, please do help them come.
And I don't usually play this on my show, but...
Thanks, Mike Novak!
I had to put that in there. Amy Beltamaki, Carol Becker, thank you so much. And I will see you guys on Thursday at the conference. I received this email the other week from one of my listeners. It's a quote. My Landreth catalog came today. Holy shoes, what a piece of work. Thanks for the tip. Can't wait to get dirty. This is what I'm talking about when I tell you that the 2012 D. Landreth Seed Company catalog is a work of art. One of the seeds you might want to order is Canterbury Bells. They are a campanula, a huge family with more than 300 different flowers, including the bell flower and a kind of bluebell. Canterbury Bells were brought to America by some of the earliest colonists in the 1600s. Joseph Breck, in his 1852 book, Breck's Book of Flowers, the first book ever written on American flowers, describes a white, blue, and rose variety and a double and single blossoming varieties. Canterbury Bells are biennials. They don't do much the first year, but they make up for it the second year with an outrageous flower spike heavily laden with the most incredibly colorful flowers. Log on to LandrethSeeds.com or call 800-654-2407. 800-654-2407. D. Landreth Seed Company, purveyor of fine seeds since 1784. Tell them Mike sent you.
At Innovative Insulation Solutions, their mission is to deliver the highest performing foam insulation systems available on today's market with an incredible R value of up to 7 per inch. Their history of safe and effective application of these systems, coupled with total dedication to quality, consistently earns their customers' trust and satisfaction. They specialize in all types of foam insulation. Spray-applied close-cell and open-cell polyurethane foam insulation, closed-wall cavity injection, and foam-in-place masonry block insulation. Innovative Insulation Solutions is totally committed to anticipating, solving, and supporting all of your foam insulation needs. Call Innovative Insulation Solutions today at 847-454-9081 or go to gotfoaminsulation.com. That's 847-454-9081 or go to gotfoaminsulation.com.
Openlands wants you to just say no. No to the proposed outdoor gun range in the Calumet region. I talked about this issue last week on my show when eagles were discovered nesting in the area. I think we're going to have a conversation about it next week as well. You can go to openlands.org to read more about what they call a serious land use conflict posed by the City of Chicago's campaign to site a police training facility within 100 yards of one of the natural, cultural, and educational crown jewels of the Millennium Reserve Project, which has also been discussed on this show. Openlands believes that building the outdoor firing range on 33 acres leased from the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Greater Chicago contradicts the pledge by Mayor Emanuel and Governor Quinn to champion the Millennium Reserve to transform the Calumet area into an ecotourist and green industry center. If you can think of a way to preserve, advocate for, and celebrate our green spaces, Openlands has probably done it. Volunteer your time, donate to a project, go online and look at their action alert, or just enjoy one of the many Openlands public spaces. Go to openlands.org for more information. Openlands, conserving nature for life. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood, so let's go to the phones and bring in meteorologist Rick DeMaio. How you doing, Rick?
Pretty good, Mike. Not bad when you have, we'll call it March-like weather in February, right?
Yeah, okay. Here's the deal. I was talking to a friend of mine in the biz yesterday in the... He works at a... it was Wally, Dr. Wally. And... what you have to understand about the garden center biz at this time of year is they're making decisions about when do they bring product in and what's the weather going to be like. And folks are already, because of this mild winter, they're champing at the bit. They want they want to get the pansies out. They can see the shoots coming up from their bulbs. And I heard a report the other day that March was going to be kind of mild, that the rest of February into March was going to be mild. Are you saying the same thing?
Yeah, the 30-day outlook, which was just issued by the Climate Prediction Center, kind of takes whatever cold weather that was you know, trying to get down here into the northern part of the United States the last 2 weeks of February. It's basically, you know, kind of squeezed it to the west coast and kind of squeezed it to the east coast of Canada, and it's not really making its way into North America. And then consequently, the pattern that we're in just seems to want to stay this way for the next probably 4 to 6 weeks. So the 30-day outlook for the month of March, which was just issued on the 15th of – actually the 16th of February, because they always wait until about the midpoint of the previous month before they go out for the next 30 days from the monthly standpoint. And, yeah, it actually gets – it actually pushes temperatures about 2 to 3 degrees above average for all the Midwest, which – is kind of funny because we've been 4 to 5 degrees above average for the entire winter. So in a sense, the above average forecast is almost below what we've been getting so far this winter season, if you kind of follow that line of reasoning there.
No, it does make sense. But the upshot of this is that it doesn't look like that bottled up cold air is going to get down here, does it?
No, it doesn't, because what happened was it looked like it was going to kind of get pinched off across parts of northeast Canada and spill over the North Pole and kind of come back into the United States. But the pattern has become so messy and diffuse that even the cold wave that they had in Europe, Eastern Europe, over the last 3 weeks is beginning to break down. And one of the things I did with my students on Friday, it's interesting because my class at Oakland Community College had about 30 students. And probably 20 of them, Mike, it's really amazing. There's a lot of students that come from the Niles area, Skokie, in and around Des Plaines, a lot of Eastern Europeans, a lot of kids that still have grandparents and, you know, relatives. And all they keep talking about is how cold the winter has been over there. I said, you know, let's go back and look at October, November, and December. And I show them these maps from the Climate Prediction Diagnostic Center. And Europe actually had a very mild winter. In fact, the sixth mildest December-January period on record. And it was only the last week of January and those first 3 weeks of February that have been so incredibly cold and snowy. And essentially, if you want to look at the Northern Hemisphere, literally we've had winter in Alaska and Northwest Canada and that part of Europe, and that's it. Everywhere else has been above mild, so has been above normal. And it looks like that's the pattern. And I was even mentioning this to the students the other day, and I was talking with someone from the National Weather Service, Paul Merzlach, who I work with at Lewis, and he says, you know what, Rick, this is one of those winters that you can look at all the parameters for what you use for surface temperature forecasting, the winds at 5,000 feet, the profile up to 15,000 feet, and the numerical models could say this and say that, but it's just one of those winters where no matter how much science you put into it, you're going to be off by about 2 or 3 degrees. And he's right, because we had temperatures get up to 47 on Friday and 48 on Thursday, and nothing 2 or 3 days out showed it was going to be that warm. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that we've had so little snow cover, only 7 days of snow so far this winter season. The ground is very, very warm. It's almost mushy in some cases. And one of the parameters that a lot of these models use for temperature forecasting is the heat flux release off the ground. So if you walk through your backyard on a normal mid-February day, even if you don't have any snow, the ground is usually kind of hard. It's kind of frozen. But if it's just mushy and the sun is able to warm that up and warm the atmosphere, those first, you know, 6 feet above the ground, it's going to make it 3 or 4 degrees above average. So I wouldn't be surprised if our growing season, all the perennials, are probably shooting up a good 3 weeks before they normally do this year, Mike.
That wouldn't surprise me a bit either. Actually, I had somebody write me this week about the ground and talk about you know, how this weather we've had is affecting the plants that are in the ground now. Now, normally, if you don't have snow in Chicago, what you get is the brutal cold, and that can be really hard on plants.
And I know where you're going with this, but we haven't even had Arctic cold this year.
Right. So
there's actually no subsoil freezing temperatures whatsoever. None.
It's amazing. There's a little bit in right outside my back door, which is northern exposure there. I've got, it's a light freeze, and there's a little bit of heaving in the soil, but that's because it's in perpetual darkness there, perpetual shade. But where there's sun, Yeah, the ground's warmed up. And it's the question I wanted to ask you is, all right, so we haven't had a lot of snow, but where do we stand in terms of moisture for the winter?
Oh, great question. You know, this is really amazing. If I asked you which January was snowier, this January or last year, which would you say was snowier?
Well, I suspect it's a trick question, and most people would probably say last year, and you're going to say this year.
Yeah, this January we actually had 12.5 inches of snow because we had those two good wallops. Last year, January 2011, in the midst of 55 or 60 inches of snow, we had 11.5, but we got a lot of snow in December, and we got a lot of snow in February, but it didn't get really much in the month of March. And so far, the snows that we've had, even though one of them was a very dry snow, the first one was more of a wet snow, and we've actually had some decent rains come through as well. So we're only about a half inch below normal for the season as far as liquid moisture, you know, liquid precipitation. But the good thing about this, Mike, is that because the ground hasn't really been frozen, whatever moisture has, whatever precipitation has fallen, has really been able to percolate down to about 3 or 4 inches into the soil. So I'm really very, very optimistic on perennials coming back with a bang. And whatever people had planted, maybe, you know, from a standpoint of tulip bulbs last November, I think this is going to be a fantastic growing season around here, only because of the fact that the moisture has not frozen, has not sublimated, meaning it has not evaporated back into the atmosphere. Whatever came is probably still in there, and now we all have to worry about is whether or not we get too much rain in the month of March. But it's just one of those winters that never really got going. It never really established itself, and I would say put a rubber stamp on it that winter 2011-2012 from a standpoint of cold is done. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get a nice little snowstorm come through, which you can, but all that really is going to do is the ground's going to say, okay, when you're done being snow and you become water again, we'll accept you in the form of rain. So really a 6 or 8 inch snowfall, I think, is just as good as a 1 to 2 inch rainfall this time of year. Because the ground is so wide open right now, any precipitation that falls is going to percolate right down into the water table.
Yeah, and that was the point I would make to that listener who was wondering about it. I would say the same precautions apply in any winter or spring, which is don't go compacting the soil because it's still moist.
Right.
You still want to, if you know, just because we haven't had a lot of cold weather. You know, actually, cold weather, one of the things it does when the ground freezes, you can walk on it without compacting
it.
You know, and this is how arborists get a lot of work done because they can bring in some heavier equipment and it doesn't compact the soil as badly. But not this year.
Right, and it's interesting because it was last year. After we had all that snow, the ground was very, very moist. Then we had some really good rains in the month of March and early April, and we had too much rain, too much to the point where the soil, where I should really say that the cropland, was so saturated the farmers couldn't get out and till, and it turned their season of normally getting their, you know, the crops in, say, the second or third week of April, they weren't getting in until about 3 weeks later. And they were concerned that, you know, a late planting means a late harvest and could get an early freeze. But I don't know if you heard, but there was a recent report from the USDA that talked about how the demand for corn in China for farmers here in the United States is going to increase tenfold over the next I forget exactly the percentage, but there's the demand for corn from China and also from parts of India is just going to go up and up and up. So
the question, I guess, becomes, will they accept genetically engineered corn, which is pretty much...
I think as Bob Barker would say, if the price is right, go for it, right?
Well, you know, that's one of the things I want to cover on the show, and this is not the time to do it, is the lawsuit that's going on right now against Monsanto by organic farmers.
I heard about that, yeah.
And it's fascinating, and I've been following it, and at some point I want to cover it on the show because they're basically suing Monsanto and trying to take back the, you know, walk back the idea that you can patent a seed. You can patent food, which leads us down a dangerous path, if you ask me. You know, that we'll discuss that in the future. So what do we got coming up this week?
Real quick, didn't they already patent a hot dog? They're not going to create another hot dog, are they?
I don't know. If it'll be a GMO hot dog is what it'll be if they do.
will be.
It'll glow or something.
Yeah, something like that. A nutrition-filled hot dog.
Oh, you know what it'll be? If they did something like that, it would be a hot dog that already has mustard built into it or something.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, just squeeze it out on the side. Oh, brother. All right, well, this week, Mike, great weather today. We had a lot of sunshine yesterday. We made it up in the upper 30s, which is typical for this time of the year. Normal highs around 37. We'll probably be close to that today. A little bit cooler, though, right along the lakefront, even though we say that Lake Michigan water temperature is around 36 degrees, which is about 4 degrees above average. Sunshine tomorrow, mid-40s, some rain on Tuesday, maybe a little wet snow on the backside. And then the next 5 to 6 days, Mike, just another pattern of them, just a mixture of clouds and sun every third day with a little bit of rain. But again, nothing in the way of any snow and nothing in the way of any Arctic cold. And I think I've said that about, I think, every time I've been on your show this winter.
Yeah, amazing. It just continues to be amazing.
It's going down as the warmest winter in 80 years. And if you really want to look at it from a standpoint of how little snow we've had, even though we're up to 15 inches, we've only had 7 days where there's been snow on the ground. Last winter, we had 63 days where we had snow on the ground.
Yikes.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, you know, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in the spring. But I think I'll tell Dr. Wally that they might want to order their pansies, get them ready, because people are going to want them early.
Yeah, I think this is an early season for sure for just about everything, Mike.
Wow. Okay, you heard it here first. Thanks. Rick DeMaio Weather. You can go to DeMaioWeather.com or go to my website, MikeNovak.net, and click on the homepage. You'll find his smiling face, and we will talk to you next week.
Okay, see you, Mike.
Take care. Bye-bye. This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. In the second hour, we're talking about collecting rain. What I just saw something. Oh, was it on my... I have to ask. I just got tweeted, on Facebook here, when I mentioned that we would be talking about this, I got a request. I've been wondering about this. How can you make rain barrel water safe for consumption? Bleach and boiling? Do we still need to worry about fecal matter from the roof? Ah, see, this is all the stuff we're going to talk about in the second hour of the show when I have... Noah Garrison from the NRDC talking about a study they just did about the potential for saving billions and billions of gallons of rainwater. And they looked at a number of cities, including Chicago. We'll talk about that. I have also gotten a Facebook post from my friend Tom Shepard from the Southeast Environmental Task Force, and there's a number of things going on. I'll mention that. I'm going to read that when we get at 10 o'clock because I don't have time to do that. And, of course, in the second part of the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about coyotes, which I think is going to be a really fascinating conversation with Chris Anker. So stick around for all of that because it's coming up next.
This hour of the Mike Novak Show is brought to you by The Care of Trees, our business's people and their love for trees. Here he is again, Mike Novak.
Oh, there's the
He's
nitro.
He's filling the nitro into the carrots.
And now the Bugs Bunny is pulling the shack away.
Y.E. Coyote, oh. Super genius.
Okay.
I like the way that rolls out. Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
Bam.
Okay. Okay. You're right.
Classics for all ages.
That was funny. And it reminds folks that the second part of this hour, we will be talking about coyotes. In urban areas, which should be really, really cool. Let's go, meanwhile, to line one. And our guest for this half hour, Noah Garrison from the Natural Resources Defense Council. How are you doing, Noah?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you guys?
Great. How are things on the left coast this morning?
They are a little bit chilly and early, I think is the way I'd describe them.
Early? What, it's early? It's only 8 o'clock there.
By my definition, that still counts as early.
You're a man after my own heart, Noah. Noah is one of the principal authors of a study that was done by the NRDC and came out in the past week or so, didn't it?
It did. We sort of soft released it in the fall, but to let people have a look at it. But we really just released it for a full audience in the past week, and hope that it can have some impact.
It's called Capturing Rainwater from Rooftops, and if you go to my website, mikenovak.net, the link to the entire document is there. It's kind of interesting. How many different cities did you look at in this?
We profiled 8 different cities across the United States in a variety of different sort of climate and geographical settings, but I think the real impact is that this practice works anywhere in the country that there's a rooftop.
And one of those cities was Chicago. Now, I'm going to ask you a question because I didn't read the study with a fine-tooth comb, but I went through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see anything from Chicago that indicated we were in the vanguard of how to capture rainwater.
Well, Chicago actually is at the front in some other ways on what are called green infrastructure practices, and these are ways that sites can take rainfall and keep it on site, trying to mimic natural hydrology. So instead of letting rain hit pavement and rooftops and parking lots and flow into storm drains and sewers and cause sewer overflows or carry pollution to water, it keeps the water on site. And Chicago actually has a really progressive program on using green roofs, which use just a thin layer of soil and some plantings and that keep rainwater on site. It sort of soaks all that water up.
But that's a different. But that's a different question. I mean,
It absolutely is. But this is sort of an additional opportunity that's then presented. This is an opportunity that cities can take advantage of now, whether they are or not. And we wanted to show sort of what's available in a variety of different cities, including Chicago.
And your point is that we have all this rain that comes down. It's a natural resource, and we really haven't paid a whole lot of attention as to how to capture it, especially when it's hitting surfaces like rooftops. Now, I just had a person write to me on Facebook, and I want to read it to you because I read this at the end of the last hour. And it's a very interesting question. And here's the question. How can you make rain barrel water safe for consumption? Bleach and boiling? Do we still need to worry about fecal matter from the roof? And that's a really good question if you're going to be capturing rainwater from your roof. And I imagine that's part of the hoops you have to jump through and the laws that have to be addressed and the safety issues that have to be addressed. And I assume you've done it in your report.
Absolutely. And in fact, the report really looks only at using rainwater from rooftops for non-potable uses. So things like irrigation, toilet flushing, clothes washing, things that wouldn't be used for drinking water or cooking or human consumption. But there are states that are looking at trying to do that. Texas has been investigating that. The state of Hawaii, people rely on rainwater for their drinking water sources. And it absolutely presents a public health and human health issue and requires appropriate amounts of treatment. I'm not going to talk about, or I don't want to give advice on specific matters of treatment. That'll vary by state and by what local public health agencies think is required. But practices using reverse osmosis, UV disinfection, chlorine, all are part of that process. And there are ways to make it safe for drinking water.
We are talking to Noah Garrison. You were the chief writer on this report, I take it?
I was one of the two chief writers, myself and Chris Kloss, who is now actually with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. But we had partnered with the Low Impact Development Center out of Maryland to write the report.
And in a way, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that we haven't looked at this issue before, and I mean the royal we, everybody. On the other hand, it is kind of surprising, don't you think, that what do you think is leading to it? Is, you know, we're talking about drought in Texas, and California has perpetual water problems. You live near Santa Monica, and California is always dealing with this, but here in the Midwest, not so much. And is that why we haven't looked at it seriously before?
Well, I think there's a variety of reasons. Right at the top, you could list that really over the past 40, 50, or 100 years, we've focused on centralized water systems in order to provide water. We really don't look at these decentralized, site-specific ways to provide water. It's your water is comes from a single or a couple of sources, is piped into a widespread transportation or conveyance network, and delivered to the tap in your house. And people really don't think about water as a local resource. So, you know, when it rains, the problem was that you needed to get that away from your house and get it away from your foundation and get it into the nearest river or the ocean or lake as quickly as possible. And that presents its own huge array of problems. It brings pollution. It causes sewer overflows. We just can't deal with the volume of water that we create by having all these paved surfaces. And so a combination of, okay, well, how do we reduce stormwater or rainfall runoff and keep that from causing flooding and other problems? And also in places like Texas and the Southwest and really even the Southeast, you know, areas we don't think of typically as having rainfall or water supply problems, have been having drought in the last 5-10 years. And so we suddenly have this need to find alternative water sources, and this presents a great solution to both problems.
Yeah, this has already been apparent in the landscaping business, and I've talked about it on this show where a lot of people now are trying to take their downspouts, put them into their yard, so at least the water goes back into the water table. This is a slightly different thing you're talking about, because you're thinking of harvesting this water and then figuring out ways to use it in non-potable situations where you're not going to drink it, but use it. I was amazed at the numbers for flushing toilets. Is that the chief use of water in America in a non-potable way?
It's one of the chief uses. There's a variety, but here's a statistic from California, and this extends to other areas of the country as well, but one of the frightening things is that in Southern California, 50% of the water budget for an average resident goes to outdoor irrigation. So 50% of the water we're using from potable supply, from your drinking water supplies, is going to watering plants and lawns.
Oh, well, and mostly lawns. Let's fess up here. I'm not a huge fan of lawns, but one of the facts that I got from your report is that listen to this, folks. 270 billion gallons of water are used each week to water 23 million acres of lawn in the United States at a cost of $40 billion annually. And the point that you're making, Noah, is that's drinkable water. That is wasting water. That's a sin. To say, you know, if you want to look at it that way, and I think a lot of it goes to lawns. We're just very careless about how we use water on lawns, and there must be some way to collect water from your rooftop and wherever else. And then, if you need to do it so much on your lawn, use the water for your lawn. Use that water, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is an unbelievable resource. Again, using Southern California as a reference, when it rains, we take 10 billion gallons of water just from a one-inch rainstorm and put it into our storm drain system and flush it out into Santa Monica Bay in the Los Angeles region. At the same time, we're using huge amounts of our drinking water supply to water lawns and other landscaping. So it's really just sort of almost a no-brainer. We absolutely should be using this resource, which is just literally free water falling from the sky, and using that in place of our potable supply to irrigate and to flush toilets and uses that we don't need drinking water for.
I just got a tweet. I got some very smart listeners here, Noah. This tweet just came in. Bleach, et cetera, doesn't remove toxins like polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons from asphalt shingles or zinc. What kind of chemicals are we talking about in roofs? Obviously, as the one person who wrote to me on Facebook mentioned, you've got animals up there, specifically birds, but also squirrels and other critters that can get up there and leave fecal matter. That's one concern. But what about the chemicals that come from roofs, shingles, and other construction materials?
There absolutely are, contaminants of concern that people should be cautious of, particularly when it comes to drinking rooftop rainwater. And that's not a practice that we recommend unless it's really authorized by local public health agencies and have specific treatment requirements. Rooftops, however, really are, compared with other paved surfaces like parking lots or roads, they contain far less toxins and a far lower level of contaminants than other runoff water. And so for non-potable sources, they're almost an ideal source of water. One of the things that people can do is there's something called a first flush diverter, which takes the first amount of rainfall that's coming off the roof and moves it away from your storage tank. And that first flush really has most of the contaminants or the highest levels of contaminants in it. So if you sort of push that to the side and take care of that first runoff, the water that's coming off rooftops is relatively clean in most cases. We still would recommend, practices like using a UV disinfection or chlorine or something else to take care of some of the bacterial or toxic issues. But the US EPA has come out and said that using rainwater from rooftops for non-potable applications like toilet flushing, like irrigation, building cooling makeup, really presents very little human health risk.
And you're also finding that, and you recommend that these systems be part of design in the future, and a number of areas are already doing that, and which is to say creating cisterns on site that can be tapped into, and so you can retrieve this water.
Absolutely. This is something that really should become part of the new design paradigm, really. As we face increasing population concerns, drought concerns, all sorts of things that place strain on aging water infrastructure across the country, being able to supply water locally for a large percentage of your needs has multiple benefits. It reduces strain on infrastructure. It reduces stormwater runoff, which is a leading source of pollution to surface waters across the United States. And it provides a free resource if you're using it for non-potable resources, uses like toilet flushing or irrigation. It's free water.
I gotta like the idea of free water, and the idea also, there's money to be made or saved by municipalities in this.
Absolutely, the transportation supply. Treatment and ultimately discharging of wastewater is a huge energy sink. It's a huge cost sink. This takes a lot of resource. And so if you can supply the water on site, you can save money, you can save energy. There's a lot of different benefits that come from this.
I always come across this, and I just got on Facebook, someone wrote, in Colorado, it's illegal to capture rainwater from your roof. And this is the one that's always thrown out there as an example of an insane law. Are we dealing with laws like that, and how do we overcome them?
Well, every state is different. The water laws change state by state, and that's one of the hurdles that need to be overcome is finding states where there are barriers to using captured rainwater and changing the laws, changing regulations, changing local ordinances on a city-by-city basis, which we deal with out in California, where in most cities you're not allowed to use the water for indoor uses, and we're working to change that. But definitely there are barriers to using captured rainwater. Colorado is a perfect example of that, and we actually talk about it in the report, where there is good reason to want to go and work to change laws. And we hope people would write to their local officials, write to their state officials and senators, and tell them that they want to be able to use captured rainwater.
We've got a call here, Noah. So let us go to line two. And who's who have we got here?
This is Chris from Palatine.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Good. I hate to be a contrarian, but I will. You're talking about, you know, I understand for the Southwest, which is a desert, which should not have the population it has right now. There was a great article in National Geographic a few years ago about the Colorado River and all the issues that were going on down there. But Illinois, we get what? In Chicago, we get, what, 50 inches of rain a year? We also have kind of a big bathtub called Lake Michigan. Why would anybody conceive of trying to do some machination about drinking, you know, rainwater, or for that matter, going through the trouble and expense of using it to flush toilets? You know, this is a closed, you know, this is a closed loop system, and the water that, you know, we use and flush gets eventually into the water table and back and recycled.
That's a very good observation there, Chris. What do you say to that, Noah?
Well, the use of captured rainwater really came out of, as I was talking about earlier on the program, a suite of practices called green infrastructure that the background came out of a water pollution control sort of approach that for 50 years, the approach in the United States has been when it rains, take that water and either put it into storm drains and gutters and get it away from developed areas as quickly as possible, dumping it into local waters with little or no treatment. So that's why it's such a high pollution source for local waters. We're putting it in different cities, putting it into the actual sewer system, which causes sewer overflows, again, a huge pollution source. And so the thinking became, if you keep that water on site and you prevent all of the pollution that it carries from reaching surface waters. And so that's where this really was born out of. The fact that you get a secondary resource out of it and can actually use that water is an incredible additional benefit. But there are pollution reasons to keep the water on site, regardless of whether the water is a real concern.
Does that address it for you, Chris?
Yeah, but again, I just think that we have a lot of issues there. You know, again, I think this should be much more geographically inclined as opposed to the upper Midwest and the East Coast that, you know, doesn't have drought issues, you know, whereas, you know, on the other hand, if you're in the Southwest or Southwest, you know, the southern part of California, you know, absolutely makes a lot of sense. But, you know, up here, I just think it's nothing to really worry about.
Well, I'm going to say I disagree with you, Chris, because I think we're getting to the point where as the population gets larger and we don't really know what some of the effects of climate change are going to be, there might be drought in certain areas. We could have drought up in the Great Lakes region. And certainly with the intensity of storms, that's going to change, and this is all going to affect the resource. And I think for us to be smart and be prepared for this is not a bad thing. I'm going to let you go, and we'll get back to Noah. Thanks for calling. I really appreciate it. This is the go ahead.
I was going to say the follow-up to that. Again, talking about we don't really know what the impacts are. The city of Atlanta in 2007 came within 3 months of running dry from its principal water source at Lake Lanier. And that's not something anyone would have foresaw, given that the southeast and areas around there get 40 to 50 inches of rain per year. People don't really see drought as a huge problem, but it can impact areas that we're not used to having water shortages.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I think that we don't know where things are going. And we just the idea that we would take the potable water and use it on lawns, again, it just it's It makes me a little crazy, and I think it makes a lot of people crazy. So how do we begin to affect governments to change their laws?
Well, it really depends on what the issue is. There are city ordinances that can serve as a barrier to rainwater capture. There are state laws that can serve. It really depends on what the problem or what the barrier is, and I would say that lobbying local officials, lobbying your city officials to tell them you want to be able to use rainwater. If it's a city ordinance, the city ordinance can be changed. If it's a statewide problem, the local officials can certainly help in leading an effort to try and draft legislation to change the laws. Colorado actually did change its law recently so that it formerly was, I believe, illegal to capture water anywhere in the state. And that's now been changed to, in some rural areas, you're allowed to capture so long as you're not connected to a municipal supply. So there's step-by-step changes being made. Texas and Atlanta in the last decade, really, have put out rainwater guides and changed their plumbing codes in order to allow captured rainwater. So It's not a one-size-fits-all fix, but it is something that can start at the local level and easily swell into a larger movement.
That is Noah Garrison, one of the authors of the NRDC's report, which is called Capturing Rainwater from Rooftops. You can find that report. I link to it on my site, MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, but you can also go to NRDC.org and track it down. I also put a link to your blog up there, Noah, because you write about a number of issues, and I'm very happy to have had you on the show, and thank you for putting that together. I think folks might want to take a look at it and then think about, you know, I'll talk to my friend Ron Cowgill, who he hosts a home improvement show here on Chicago's Progressive Talk on Saturdays. He's always looking at green solutions, and this is one that I need to ask him about, because I wonder if he's done it. Oh, we got one more call before we let him go? Okay. Hold on just a second, Noah.
Sure.
Hi, you're on the Mike Novak Show.
Hey, Mike, it's Dave from Madison.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
Good. Great guests, and just wanted to mention, I think the previous caller, you know, with all due respect, you were right, that we have a huge problem with polluted runoff here, and reinfiltrating and reusing this water is going to make an enormous, enormous difference. And we have rivers up here in Wisconsin that go dry because of the lack of infiltration. So we absolutely do have drought problems, but that's not the only reason. We have major water problems. And your guest is absolutely right. We can control a lot of that with reusing this rainfall.
And I think one of the things that I've become aware of is that the way we look at water now, we actually turn it into a poison. We let the water come down. It comes off the rooftop. It goes onto the street. It washes through chemicals. It washes oils. And then we try to rehabilitate it. And wouldn't it be better if we could intercept it somewhere along the line, as Noah's been talking about, where it doesn't get to such a degraded point, and put it back into the system? See, that's interesting, the concept. And what did you call it, Noah, where you allow some of the water to go first to wash off the bad stuff, and then you start to collect it? What's that system called?
It's called a first flush diverter. But it usually takes that first volume of water that comes off the roof or really off of any surface and diverts it away from your storage tank. And that first volume of water really usually has the highest amount of pollution in it, or the highest percent of pollution in it. So the water that comes after that is typically much cleaner and much more ready for use.
And that sounds like a great way to deal with it.
Well, and Mike, one quick thing. That's exactly right. You want to prevent the pollution at first. And remember, the lifetime of a roof, you have toxics that change over the time. So in the beginning of an asphalt roof, the first couple of years, you're going to get the PAHs that I tweeted about and zinc and all these other things. That starts to be reduced over the years and then increase again as the shingles become degraded. So those are kind of things that it's the time frame we're looking at as well to decide whether we're going to use that. And then the last thing I would just mention is for things like some of these pollutants, zinc, that'll be trapped in the first inch of soil or so. But for other things like maybe cadmium, you're going to have to be careful about irrigating crops like tomatoes, because those are preferential accumulators of cadmium, and you'll want to be real careful. But I'll hang up and listen. Mike, it's another great show.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Thank you again, Noah, for stopping by. And I think folks should take a look at this. And it's an issue that's, as you point out, state to state, you have to work it that way. And sometimes city to city and work around those laws. But it's something we need to be looking at.
My pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
Have a great Sunday.
Take care.
Bye. This is the Mike Novak Show on Chicago's Progressive Talk, AM and FM. In just a couple of minutes, coyotes or coyotes or however you want to pronounce it. Here's a tip from the care of trees. Do you know that tree care is a more dangerous job than police work or firefighting? At least that's what a study by the University of South Dakota shows. Every year, Homeowners are injured or killed trying to do their own tree work. You should think twice before performing tree work of any kind, especially if it involves climbing, work from a ladder to prune a tree, and certainly attempting to cut down a tree. The problem is that in this economy, you're going to be tempted to do it yourself to save a couple of bucks. But the care of trees is fully insured to cover workers' compensation, property damage, and personal liability in case of accidents. Are you? Make the care of trees your permanent partner in enhancing the value of your landscape. Whether you want to make sure all is well with the trees in your yard or you're changing your landscaping, invite the certified arborist, and that's the key. They're certified and bonded at the care of trees to take a look. See thecareoftrees.com or call 847-394-4220. 847-394-4220. The care of trees. Their business is people. And their love for trees.
Allergies acting up, trouble breathing, headaches, sinus pressure, you're tired, congested. Isn't it time to feel better? Breathe deeply and easily. Get rid of the symptoms that complicate your life. Dr. Bonnie Flaster is an acupuncturist and chiropractor who helps people get rid of allergies without using drugs, shots, or needles. Call Dr. Flaster at River North Wellness Center, 312-642-7545. Or go to rivernorthwellness.com to find out how to get your body feeling better so you can enjoy life again.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
I think it's time. Oh, you know, what I probably should do at this point is get. I have to go through all the machinations here to. I can do that. Let's get the Wile E. Coyote sound effect back up. Do-do-do-do-do-do. Here we are. This is the one. Okay. And while we're doing that. And the nitroglycerin is pouring into the carrots. Let's go to line two and bring in Chris Anker. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am.
Hang on for a second.
Super genius. I like the way that rolls out. Wile E. Coyote, super genius.
Now, is that what most of the coyotes you deal with say on a daily basis, Chris?
Not normally.
Chris Anker is with the Cook County Forest Preserve District. He's a field biologist. He has been part of a study that is going on in Cook County. It's called the Cook County, Illinois Coyote Project. Now, how do you pronounce it, Chris?
Coyote or coyote are both acceptable.
They're both acceptable. Okay. So we'll go with coyote, and how long has this study been going on?
We're going into our 12th year now.
One thing I was looking for on the study, and I should mention that because I'm going to bring in Nancy Gonciorek in a second, but you're going to be speaking next Saturday at the Wildflower Preservation and Propagation Committee's annual Tending the Earth Seminar, which is up at McHenry County. It's McHenry County College Conference Center, and we'll get all that information from Nancy Gonciorek in just a second. I was looking through the study, and the one thing I couldn't find, and maybe I just missed it, was the actual number of coyotes, or your guesstimate for the number of coyotes in Cook County or the environs. Do you have any numbers like that?
It would be a guess. No one really knows. It's impossible to come up with a number to defend. It would be in the thousands, but beyond that, I wouldn't want to even hazard a guess.
But thousands, not tens of thousands?
Correct.
Okay. So, but that's still significant because considering that they're predators. And one of the things that I'm always noting is that we as a species, and I'm talking about humanoids, are very good at taking out predators. We don't like having predators around. So we tend to push them into smaller and smaller areas. First we kill them in great numbers, and then we push them away. But it seems to me that the coyote is a predator that's managed to do an end around humans. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. This is an animal that has been, particularly out west, has been persecuted for generations and has survived and done wonderfully. In our area, at the turn of the last century, coyotes, white-tailed deer, beavers, Canada geese were basically extirpated throughout Illinois. And coyotes, along with the aforementioned animals, all returned on their own into the Chicagoland area during the late 60s. So these are animals that are very adaptable, and they've learned to reestablish themselves amongst us. And they've done it very, very well.
And how is that? Because you mentioned that they're called the ghosts of the prairie, and now they're kind of the ghosts of the city as well. Is that part of
it? It was one of the things that was truly amazing. Before this study had started, if you had talked to 10 different biologists in the area and asked, you know, where do coyotes live and how many coyotes are there and what are these coyotes actually doing, you would have gotten 10 different opinions. But since the inception of the study and the fact that the study has gone on for so long and now we've handled over 500 animals, making it the largest study of its kind, what we've come to understand is that the coyotes are everywhere, even into the heart of the city of Chicago. They're living amongst us, and they have been for a number of years now, and they're doing it very successfully.
So is that a reason to fear them?
No. The vast majority of the animals are living amongst us, and people have no idea that they're even there. From the telemetry work that we've done, the coyotes are living successfully in people's backyards, literally in people's backyards, and the vast majority of them cause no trouble, and most people are totally oblivious to their presence.
That's interesting. So if you're out in your yard, you're being watched probably by at least occasionally by
at least
a coyote.
Absolutely. That would be accurate.
Wow. Even in the city. And you know, what you hear in the news, and you've mentioned this in the report, the only time anybody talks about coyotes is when it wanders into a Walgreens or something. And then everybody freaks out and says, oh, my goodness, how did that coyote get into the city? But what you're saying is, no, they're there. You know, just this one just, you know, needed to buy a magazine.
He got stuck on the street, and he didn't make it back to the rally point where they spent the day. And he got basically pushed into a doorway. I'm assuming you're talking about the Quiznos coyote.
Yeah, the Quiznos. Yeah. I couldn't remember exactly where it was, but
no, there's a whole group of coyotes that live down in that area, and that animal was not lost. It just was misplaced. So.
And that's interesting because they're obviously smart enough not to get into those situations, but occasionally it's going to happen, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Another thing I found fascinating from the study is that, one, they're not long-lived. If you had a coyote called Big Mama who lived to be 11 years old, and that's a long time for a coyote, isn't it?
That is truly exceptional, and it's ironic that the very first coyote that we put a collar on as a part of this study ended up to live as long as she did. It was truly an amazing animal.
Why do you think that was? Was she just more successful at finding shelter and food?
That was definitely one aspect, but another aspect about that individual was the fact that she, for whatever reason, did not contract a lethal infection of heartworm. Most of our coyotes, by the time they get to be 3 or 4 years old, if they can make it through their first year, succumb to heartworm, to the debilitating effects of heartworm. When that first individual died and we were able to retrieve her body and have a necropsy performed by a pathologist, what we found out was that the she only had a couple of heartworms in her body, which is truly amazing. Why that animal did not succumb when many of her siblings and partners over the years did is a complete mystery to us.
You're mentioning, you know, that you capture them and you tag them. How difficult is that for you, considering how stealthy they are?
It's very difficult. It took us 3 years to learn how to do a good job of capturing a coyote. They're very intelligent, and once you catch one, they're even more difficult to catch a second time, as you might imagine. They learn, and it's obvious that they actually think about what's going on around them. They're not just acting on instinct.
That is Chris Anker with the Cook County Forest Preserve District. He's a field biologist. We're talking about coyotes. If you have a question or a coyote spotting, you're welcome to call us. It's 773-763-9278. Let's bring in Nancy on the line, too. Hi, Nancy. How you doing?
Good morning, Mike. I'm doing well. How about you?
Great. Glad to have you on the show. I'm going to be asking Chris more questions because this is you know, I go for the low-hanging fruit here. When I saw you were going to have a guy talking about coyotes, I said, okay, I got to go for this. I got to talk to him. This is just too cool. But it's just part of the annual seminar that you do each year up in McHenry County. I once told you, I think, that it must be something in the water that makes the people up in McHenry such good conservationists. And it looks like you've got a great seminar for next Saturday. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, I think we have a fabulous show every year, and we always have our show the last Saturday in February at the McHenry County Conference Center, now called the Lecht Conference Center, just so you know it's the same place. We have, starting off the day, Jim Nardi, who's a research scientist at U of I, and he will be talking about soil, and I know that's a topic that's very near and dear to your heart,
well,
Mike.
Well, actually, it was kind of a talk. It wasn't. He just lost out. You know, I thought, well, okay, I can talk about the soil, but I talk about soil before. I've never talked about coyotes. So I went with the coyotes.
And you could call Jim anytime, and he would be happy.
You know what? I should. Yeah, I think that's cool.
You should. Because I really believe many gardeners, and I'm, of course, a McHenry County Master Gardener as well as working with our native group, I just find too many gardeners don't pay enough attention to their soil.
Well, as I learned in my Master Gardener training, about 95% of what goes on with plants happens below the soil line. And, you know, that may or not be true, but it gives you an idea of how important the soil is.
Yes, and I'm very anxious to ask Jim about earthworms because I was at a program a couple weeks ago. Have you heard about the Eco-Myth Alliance?
I'm not sure I have. Explain it.
It's a nonprofit organization out of the North Shore, and they were sharing an eco-myth with us at this program that apparently earthworms may not be as great for the soil as we thought, and actually they may not be good for woodlands at all. So I'm anxious to talk to Jim about that.
I've heard about that. I've heard that earthworms, because they're not native, that some folks especially in Minnesota, from what I heard, the earthworms are destroying the duff, which is the debris on the forest floor. And it is a serious problem. And I think that is a good question to bring up. And what else?
Well, Neil DeBall, who is a very popular speaker in northeastern Illinois and southern Wisconsin, he owns the Prairie Nursery in Wisconsin, and he's a grower and consultor for all things native. And he'll be talking about landscaping for birds, butterflies, and people. And I think that's always a great topic for our audiences because one of the benefits of native gardening is that we provide food and shelter for our good native species, birds and butterflies and attract them so that we can enjoy watching them. So mm-hmm. that's always a perennial favorite topic. And Neil's a great speaker. You probably met him on the garden show circuit, I'm sure.
I was trying to remember if I have. I'm not sure, but it's quite possible I have.
Sometimes we have him talk about restoration as well, which he does in addition to providing information for gardens, for backyard garden projects. He also does restoration work in larger areas, and then I always think of him as kind of the WWF of restoration because he comes in and he talks about you come in and you sweep through with your herbicides and your fire and your power tools and you annihilate the soil and then turn it into a prairie, and it's quite a process.
The WWF for the WPPC. Is that what
too many initials. Right,
exactly. Every time I hear the your initials, WPPC, I think, didn't they used to be the Soviet Union? But it's different letters.
My husband says it sounds like a radio program, WPPC.
It kind of does. I am the morning conservationist at WPPC.
You could be our spokesman, Mike.
I'm always happy to do it.
I forgot.
I've done that before. Been up there and spoken to your folks, and it's a great crowd always up there.
And we'd love to have you back sometime. Everybody enjoys you. So lastly, we'll be ending our show celebrating our own project, which is our Natural Garden in Your Yard program. And for the past 5 years, we have had a mentoring program in McHenry County. There's a lot of people that want to go native in their yards, and they just don't even know where to start.
Mm-hmm.
So we match them up with a seasoned gardener, native gardener, and we give them a discount on plants at our plant sale, which will be coming up, and I hope I can talk about that for a sec. But
not too long. I got more questions for Chris about coyotes.
I know, he's so interesting. But this year we will mentor our 100th yard in McHenry County.
Woo!
Which is very exciting. And I have to say kudos to Carol Rice and Jim Keenan. Carol especially has spearheaded this project, and it was her little idea back 5 years ago, and it's blossomed into such a fabulous program. So we'll just be celebrating that and showing a lot of success stories. So it's always fun to see those photos of nothing, bare lawn, and turning into a beautiful native garden.
It's great stuff.
So that'll be a fun program. And then lastly, I'll just say that our native plant sale, if you don't know where to get plants, is always the first Sunday in May. And again, it's at the McHenry County College in the cafeteria. And this year that will be May 6th. Sunday starts at noon. People line up to get the best choices. We have the best selection of woodland around.
Fabulous. We also have a caller, so let us go to Catherine in Oak Park. Hi, Catherine. You're on the Mike Novak Show.
Hi, Mike. We have seen coyotes in Oak Park now for the last probably 5 years. But we're wondering why we never hear them at night, like you do in the country, you know, hear them howling. We've never heard a coyote at night.
Chris, why don't they hear them?
That's a good question. Typically, the call I get is, what is the animal that they're hearing at night? Typically, the animals will communicate at night when they're trying to rendezvous. They're trying to let each other know where the rest of the pack is at. And typically what stimulates it is an ambulance or a squad car, fire truck going by. I really couldn't tell you why you haven't heard one.
So we don't have the – see, they're still studying this, Catherine.
Okay.
You know, it took them 3 years to figure out how to capture these guys and tag them. But I'll bet that, Chris, sometime in the future – I mean, that's one of the things you're trying to find out, isn't it?
Their social communication patterns are – very important to understanding the behavior in the Chicagoland area, absolutely.
Well, thank you for the call, Catherine. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. Our phone number is 773-763-9278. Hang on just a second, Chris and Nancy. I'll be right back with you. We'll be talking a little more. I have a couple more questions about the coyotes. And by the way, if you want information on the seminar for next Saturday at the WPPC, it's all on my website, MikeNovak.net. Go to this week's show, scroll down. You will find all that information. Now, when you order from the D. Landreth Seed Company, you're going to get some history, too. I had a guy tweet me just today that his rhubarb was coming up. Well, they've got one called Victoria rhubarb. The name rhubarb is believed to have come from the Latin. Now, you're going to get a Latin lesson here. Ra barbarum. Ra is the ancient name for the Volga River in Russia, and barbarum means barbarian. Surprise. The Romans were introduced to rhubarb by barbarians living along the banks of the Volga, where the plant grew freely. So the Romans called the plant rhubarb because it was grown by barbarians living on the banks of the Ra. What other radio station are you going to get this on? That's what I have to ask you. The Chinese ground the root into a yellow powder used for a number of medicinal purposes. And in early Europe, you'll appreciate this, Heather, it was used to treat rickets, leprosy, and freckles. Rhubarb became popular as a culinary vegetable in the early 1800s when an Englishman, Joseph Myatt, began bringing the stalks to market each week. By 1839, the Landreths offered the Victoria variety in its catalogs. The Victoria variety is today still the most popular rhubarb variety under cultivation. You can order it by logging on to LandrethSeeds.com, L-A-N-D-R-E-T-H, Seeds.com, or call 800-654-2407, or find them on Facebook. D. Landreth Seed Company, purveyor of fine seeds since 1784.
At Innovative Insulation Solutions, their mission is to deliver the highest performing foam insulation systems available on today's market with an incredible R value of up to 7 per inch. Their history of safe and effective application of these systems, coupled with total dedication to quality, consistently earns their customers' trust and satisfaction. They specialize in all types of foam insulation. Spray-applied close-cell and open-cell polyurethane foam insulation, closed-wall cavity injection, and foam-in-place masonry block insulation. Innovative Insulation Solutions is totally committed to anticipating, solving, and supporting all of your foam insulation needs. Call Innovative Insulation Solutions today at 847-454-9081 or go to gotfoaminsulation.com. That's 847-454-9081 or go to gotfoaminsulation.com.
Did you know that approximately 1,000 trees die in Chicago every year due to neglect? Compare that to forest trees, which can live for over 100 years. But those trees don't have to contend with pollution, limited space for growth, and other urban pressures. That's why since 1991, Openlands has worked to train volunteers to become tree keepers, ordinary people focused on community forestry who plant, maintain, and monitor trees throughout the greater Chicago region. Over the course of 7 3-hour Saturday classes, experts teach tree keepers about biology, physiology, and benefits of trees, soil science, tree identification, mulching, pruning, and planting. How do I know? I'm tree keeper number 417, and I couldn't be prouder. Spring 2012 tree keeper classes will run on Saturdays from March 3rd to April 14th at Trumbull Park, 2400 East 105th Street, in Chicago, in the South Deering neighborhood. For more information about tree keepers or to register for classes, contact Jim DeHorn at 312-863-6259 or log on to openlands.org. Openlands.org. You can also find Openlands on Facebook and Twitter. Openlands, enriching our enjoyment of natural spaces since 1963. We're in the home stretch here on the Mike Novak Show. Now, Heather, the calls are pouring in now about coyotes, huh? Is that what's going on? We're talking to Nancy Gonciorek and Chris Anker. Nancy, we just had somebody call. They don't have a computer. If they want a phone number for how to get to the Propagation Committee's seminar, what's the number?
They can call me, 815-455-4000. 8151-9462.
Once again, 815. I didn't write it down, so go. I was going to write it down.
The number, Mike, 455.
Oh, there it is. I have it right there. Okay, that number. Okay.
Okay, 815.
Mm-hmm.
455-9462. And don't call until 10 minutes from now.
Because she won't pick up because she's on the radio. Chris, a couple of quick questions for you. One of the things I note is that coyotes, they rarely make it out of their first year, right?
That's correct, which is true of many wild animals. The highest mortality rate for most animals is their youth, when they're first getting out and getting away from the security of the den site or denning area. And their first forays into the environment around them are fraught with perils. And for the most part, it's vehicle accidents that cause them to die.
Hmm. Now, the big question people have, and I'm sorry, I'm not going to be able to get to Brenda in Elgin because we're just about out of time. But I wanted to ask about whether people need to worry about their pets. This is the main thing. When people rail against coyotes, they say, well, it's going to spirit off my little doggy. How often does that happen?
It happens fairly often this time of year. We're right in breeding season right now, and the animals are incredibly territorial. And when people let their dogs out, or their cats, and particularly if they're not monitoring them or allow them to run free, they are susceptible to being picked off by coyotes, either because of a territorial infringement. In other words, they're trying to protect their territory, or actually that the coyotes are looking at them as food. So they're actually grabbing them, destroying them, and consuming them. So there's two different factors there involved.
Wow.
One thing you can do is keep your pets close to you and always keep them on a leash.
But sometimes, well, they do go after pets on leashes, according to your report also.
They can, but that very rarely occurs. Typically what happens is that the coyotes will face off with you and let their presence be known, but they won't press the attack if the animal is secured on a leash.
We're out of time. I was going to ask you about, you know, whether they control rodents. Do they do that at all?
They consume many rodents. They're totally opportunistic.
Well,
rabbits are what's available. That's what they'll take. If it's mice, that's
okay. Well, I'm sorry. We're flat out of time. Chris, it's been great. Nancy, wonderful stuff. Go to my website for more information. And for the rest of you, all I've got to say is go green or go home.